black holes. Scott.
All right, thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. Nice to see a few of you who I actually know. It's nice to be back in Santa Barbara. Okay, there are two main parts to my talk, two different kinds of black holes. Okay, and I invite you to ask questions as we go. When I break for these two topics, I may ask if you have any questions. Okay, so what I'm talking about here are black holes which are static and which are interacting with each other. So I'm talking about pairs of black holes, maybe even many more than that. Okay, in particular, in this first part, I'm talking about two black holes in a certain, from a certain point of view. And I'll explain what that means when we get to it. And in the second part, I'm talking about as many black holes in principle as one wishes. Okay. And by the way, in the first part of the talk, I'm talking about a single extra dimension is the emphasis. And in the second part of the talk, I'm just talking about no extra dimensions. Okay. So the first part of the talk, black holes in a certain model of extra dimensions. This is work I did with Doug Eardley, who's actually at KITP. So the work that I'm summarizing is in these two archive articles. They will be coming out in PhysRev soon. Okay, so I'm going to start with some introduction just to kind of warm you up. You've heard some of this already. Aaron talked about extra dimensions, in fact, a Randall Sundrum model. Okay, but regardless of the model, the basic ingredients are as follows. Okay, so just to back up all the way, when Einstein developed general relativity, you know, his starting point was to say we have four dimensions in sum, right? Three space dimensions, one time dimension, and he said that the curvature, okay, of space-time produces gravity. Okay, that's essentially what general relativity is. And once he did that, it wasn't very long before people started talking about could there be other dimensions, more dimensions than a total of four space-time dimensions. So we can apply general relativity in any number of dimensions. And the idea of introducing an extra dimension is that for some reason, one reason or another, we are confined to a hypersurface. Our observed four-dimensional universe could be a surface, okay, in the higher dimension. So in the sketch here, the extra dimension runs this way. How big is that extra dimension? It's a good question, so save that thought. Okay, now, in these models, it's typical to allow standard model fields, okay, particle physics, to be confined to the brain. And by the way, the surface is often called the brain. Okay, gravity is different. It's fundamentally different. It knows about all the extra dimensions. It is the curvature, or due to the curvature, of all space-time dimensions. So in particular, if we have a black hole that, for one reason or another, exists and sits on the brain, okay, it cannot be a disk confined to the brain. It must be a higher dimensional object. It must be a bulk object, as we say. So we often refer to the extra dimensional nature of the situation as the bulk, okay, as opposed to the brain. Now, whatever model you have in mind, it must reproduce what Newton said about gravity. Okay, so in particular, let's imagine we have two particles that are on the brain. If they are a far enough distance away from each other, so farther away from each other, a larger distance of separation than the typical scale or size of that extra dimension, okay, then the model should reproduce what Newton said about gravity. It should recover an inverse square law, okay, for the gravitational force. Now, if those particles approach each other, and if their separation is small enough, and let's say smaller than the typical size of that extra dimension, then the higher dimensional nature of gravity, okay, will reveal itself, and you'll get an inverse cube law for one extra dimension, not an inverse square law. Okay, and so that's the two behaviors that we have. What Newton said at large distance, higher dimensional at sufficiently small distance. And we are imagining perhaps this could be happening in an experiment at the LHC in a high energy collision. Okay, now the nature of this setup is that the higher dimensional setup, okay, relates to what's happening in one lower dimension on the brain. Okay, and so higher dimensional or five-dimensional quantities can be related to lower dimensional, four-dimensional quantities. okay, on the brain. Now, this is not a main point of the talk, but it's worth mentioning that in the particular model that I'm going to be talking about, or one of them, okay, one of the motivations, in fact, was to use this and use the geometry, okay, of the extra dimensions to actually explain the hierarchy. That's the hierarchy between the four-dimensional Planck mass, okay, 10 to the 19 GeV, and the TeV scale, okay, TeV scale. And if you arrange it so that in the higher dimensional perspective, in the bulk perspective, if the five-dimensional Planck mass, and that's just the different combination, essentially, of h-bar and c, okay, if you arrange that based on the geometry, and the details depend on the particular model, if you arrange that to be around a TeV, okay, then it turns out a consequence of that is the following. Okay, what is the higher dimensional Planck mass? Okay, well, that sets the scale for the smallest possible black hole. Okay, and so what this means is if we live in such a universe, okay, on a brain in such a model, then at the LHC, we can hope to be producing small black holes. It's a natural consequence, okay, of this setup. Now, henceforth, I'm going to use units in which speed of light is 1. I'm going to use the relativist convention of mass equals energy, okay? Use those terms interchangeably. Okay, now a good question here is, could this black hole, if it's produced, let's say, in a high-energy collision on the brain, could it escape into the bulk? And if that were true, what would it look like in at the LHC? Well, it would be essentially missing energy, energy that would be, disappear. Okay. Now, perhaps gravitons would go the other way. If a black hole goes one way, gravitons probably emitted the other in the other direction. Okay. Could this happen? Maybe it could. Maybe it couldn't. Okay. Now, I'm going to introduce you now to the basic model that I'm going to be talking about. This is developed by Lisa Randall and Raman Sundram. This is their second model, so-called RS2 model. Okay. Now, so this here is the brain, and there's the bulk. And the bulk is actually filled with a constant energy density. In fact, it's negative. Lambda, the so-called cosmological constant. Okay. Now, the brain has a couple of properties. It has a surface energy, okay, and in magnitude, the same number. Okay, and that's we refer to it as a tension. It's analogous to surface tension. So we're referring to the brain as sort of a lower dimensional object in a higher dimensional bulk. So it's analogous to a surface or a film. Okay. Now, let's see. In general relativity, pressure gravitates, negative pressure repels. Another way to say that is tension repels. So a brain by itself, if it carries tension, that's little lambda. I'm calling it little lambda 1 in anticipation of a second brain that I will be mentioning. Okay. So the brain by itself produces a repulsive effect to objects. Okay. Now, the brain has another important ingredient. This is called a mirror symmetry or an orbifold symmetry, Z2. I'll be referring to Z2 in the figures, so-called Z2 symmetry. A mirror reflection symmetry is what it is. Okay. And what this means is the following. It's a very strong restriction. What it says is that what happens on one side of the brain must be mirror reflected on the other side of the brain. So in fact, if you have a black hole, right, it must be symmetric. Okay. And if you like, there's only one physical side of the brain. You can choose one side and say that's the physical side. The other side, a copy, a mirror copy, you might call it an image copy if you like. Okay. So I'm going to be concerned with measuring quantities and considering quantities on one side of the brain only. That will be the physical space. I may from time to time refer to what's happening on the other side. Okay. And in particular, the question we just asked a minute ago, right, could a black hole leave the brain and have gravitons being emitted the other way? Well, that would be forbidden in this mirror symmetric setup. Okay, it's not mirror symmetric, therefore forbidden. So it's a very, very strong restriction, a very strong condition, okay, this mirror symmetry. Okay, what do we know about small black holes on brains, okay, in this setup? Well, it turns out that numerically, numerical methods are the best way to study these black holes. They've been essential to study them. We don't have any analytic solutions for such black holes. Okay. Small black holes on the brain have been constructed numerically. Okay. And that's been going on for a number of years. And in fact, some very recent work was done as well. So a good question is this black hole stable? Okay. Okay. Why would you ask the question? Well, as we said, a brain produces by itself a repulsive gravitational effect. And so the black hole is just sitting there. Why wouldn't it want to fly off somehow? Okay, by some means.
Can I ask you a question about the repulsive?
Yeah, sure.
So when you said that first, I thought that the positive lambda 1 would be repulsive in the sense that it's like a cosmological constant, on the brain. So I guess I'm wondering.
Yeah. I'm going to back up a slide to go.
How that translates. Well,
I use a little lambda. In our paper, I use this notation simply to avoid confusion with another. It's often called sigma or something to avoid confusion with lambda, perhaps. In fact, the cosmological constant on the brain is in fact zero, and it takes a little effort to see that. In other words, the tension is a sort of, let me say it this way, the tension is a quantity, sort of an extrinsic quantity, we might say. It's sort of, it has relevance when we're considering the brain in the bulk. But on the brain itself, the effective cosmological constant is in fact zero. Okay, and...
Does that imply a relationship between lambda 1 and capital lambda?
Sure, sure, and that's coming in a slide or two. Absolutely.
That's something you're opposing, that you want the cosmological constant on the brain to be zero.
Yeah, in fact, one can generalize, and yes, there's a very special condition of relationship between the brain tension and the cosmological constant. Yeah, and if you generalize that, of course, you can get a non-zero cosmological constant on the brain. Okay. Okay, good question. Okay, so what we were just saying a minute ago was, there's a repulsion effect, a repulsive gravity effect due to the brain. There's also an attraction, right? Because, you might think it's funny to discuss the half of the black hole being attracted to its other half. It perhaps becomes a little clearer if you imagine a black hole sitting out here off the brain, being attracted to its image. And this is very, similar to what happens in electrostatics with image charges, okay? Although we're not discussing charges, electric charge here. Okay, and in this case, in this particular second example, you can actually anticipate there probably is this very small black hole solution, okay, a black hole that levitates in the bulk, and it's where you would expect the attraction and repulsion to balance. Okay, now keep in mind that the language of forces is a good intuition, but it's not perhaps the most precise language to analyze the problem with, because, as we know, gravity is not a force in general relativity. It's related to geometry, okay, related to curvature. Okay. All right. Yeah, question. Yeah.
So if the attraction were stronger than the repulsion, then what would happen?
Okay, well, if the attraction is stronger than the repulsion, well, then it would win, and it would fall to the brain and sit there.
Sorry, then
it would, the black hole would fall towards the brain and,
right,
and then be on that brain eventually.
And does that count as a static, stable?
No, that would be unstable. Okay, and in
unstable the way you've drawn it there, but once it gets to the brain.
Oh, sure. Once it gets to the brain, it would eventually what? Well, it make gravitational waves and so forth, and then eventually just sit there and be static. That's what we would expect. Yeah. So these are the ideas that I'm going to be analyzing in more detail. Yeah.
You're probably going to answer this, but when you say stable, you mean classically stable?
I mean classically stable. Yeah, there's no quantum in this talk. Yes, everything's classical here. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
I'm sorry, so by static, you mean non-rotating?
I mean non-rotating and non-translating.
Okay, and the mass is staying the same, or is it?
Yes, mass also the same. Okay. Yeah, not changing. Okay. Well, the questions, by the way. No? Okay, so this is the Randall-Sundrum model without black holes. This serves as a description of the asymptotic geometry. So in particular, up here, this is the geometry, okay, without black holes. And let's see, This is the warp factor, omega. In Aaron's talk, she mentioned the warp factor, and this is the warp factor in different coordinates. And in these different coordinates, the coordinate z is related to the coordinate that Aaron used in a very simple way. But what it does is it makes the warp factor appear as a conformal factor. It multiplies, what is this? This is the metric, the Minkowski metric, okay, four dimensions, and z here, the extra dimension. Okay. Now, in this language, the conformal factor, the warp factor, is a conformal factor, and everything's warped. Okay, the extra dimension is warped, and if you like, all the dimensions are warped, if you like to say it that way. Okay, so, and by the way, this is in fact, geometrically speaking, a slice of an anti-de-Sitter space. Anti-de-Sitter meaning a negative bulk cosmological constant, lambda. Now we can rephrase that quantity in terms of an effective pressure, cosmological constant space times our perfect fluids. You can associate a pressure with that, essentially negative lambda up to a constant involving the Newton constant g. Okay, and let's see. So this here is a graph of the warp factor, and this is one brain. This brain has positive tension, lambda 1. The second brain, we're going to let that disappear from our talk shortly, okay, has negative tension. Yeah?
So is it the z2
orbit folding
that creates the effective force? Because without that, I wouldn't have the image mass, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And so without z2, then the mass wouldn't, there wouldn't be something pulling it towards
the. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, the orbit fold is creates the image, yes, and that creates the attraction. And we're going to come back to that, and we'll see it explicitly happening eventually. Now, the length between the brains, by the way, the proper length, okay, can be calculated, depends on little l. What is little l? Well, little l serves as a sort of a natural scale. The Ricci curvature scalar of the space is proportional to 1 over little l squared. Okay. And it's just a convenient quantity to have in mind. Okay. And the fine-tuning we were mentioning before comes about as follows. Essentially, so short answer, you take an anti-de-Sitter space like this, and you slice it once, and what you have over there, you paste over there. So you remove this part of the anti-de-Sitter space, and if you wish to continue it, you simply copy what's there over. That creates a brain. The acting of cutting and pasting creates a brain. Okay. And
did I miss why it's L over Z? Is it just because of dimensions?
Choice of coordinates?
Just
a choice of coordinates, yeah. Horospherical coordinates or Poincaré coordinates, they are sometimes called. Okay, and you can do a second cut and paste if you wish, and that creates a brain. Okay. All right, and the acting of cutting and pasting makes the geometry, and I'll have a slide coming up shortly. There's sort of a kink in the geometry, and that kink is the brain. Okay. All right. Now you can. Consider a single brain limit, this negative tension brain, okay, taken to infinity. It actually serves as a regulator when needed. Okay, and this is the setup I'll be considering, just a single brain in the Randall-Sundrum setup. Positive brain tension, negative cosmological constant, both related okay, to each other by virtue of those relationships which are, linked. Okay. All right, now by the way, this second model here cannot solve the hierarchy problem. You need the hierarchy, that's the warp factor, which serves to relate the two scales, as Erin already mentioned in her talk. Okay, the Planck scale and the TED scale. Okay, so let's see, what I'm going to be considering are the following. Where's the black hole? Is it on the brain? Is it off the brain? I'm not specifying. I'm going to be considering both possibilities, so I just left that open, ended there. Okay. We have, in principle, two brains, one positive tension, one negative tension. We have a moment of time. Okay, so we're just considering spatial geometry. I'm going to be writing down some spatial geometry. Okay. And there's a well-known procedure in general relativity to write down a situation which is at the instant chosen, initially at rest, right? The geometry is not changing in time at that moment. It could change later in time, however. Okay. And here's the thing. Okay. Black holes obey. What is the physics of black holes, by the way? They obey what are called laws, which are very much analogous to the laws of thermodynamics. Okay. And these were worked out in the 60s. And if we keep various things constant, now you can read our paper and see what happens if we don't keep those things constant. Okay. What happens is you get more terms here. Okay. But if we hold these things constant, this little l and those warp factors, okay, we worked out the first law. Okay. So every black hole system, you expect a first law to hold. You have to sort of work it out to see what more general terms you get. You always get the area term. And this says something very simple. So what it says is it relates the mass or energy of the space-time, okay, to changes in the black hole area. Okay. And this is very much analogous to thermodynamics. Area proportional to entropy, this quantity here proportional to temperature, as Hawking had to show using a quantum calculation. Okay. But it says something even simpler than that for our purposes. It says that if we consider variations under which the area is not changing, okay, then the mass is extremized. It's an extremum. Okay. So if the black hole is static, it obeys this law. If the black hole is static, then, okay, it extremizes its mass when the area is fixed. And you can try to run this in reverse, and it takes some effort to make a proof, but we did prove it in one of our papers. Okay, if we run it in reverse, it says the following. Okay, if the mass is extremized, holding the area fixed and holding these other quantities fixed, then the black hole is static. And what this serves to do is you can write down some initial data, as we say, or initial geometry, okay, and look, as I will show you shortly, for a mass extremum. And what that does is it identifies among all the initially static black holes, it selects out those that remain static or remain at rest. Okay. And this is essentially the interpretation that I'm advertising in my title. Okay, it's the fact that static black holes extremize total energy, okay, or mass in this language. Okay, so here's a sketch. Okay, you can visualize the spatial geometry with a wormhole picture if you wish. This is just a sketch. Okay, so this right here is the black hole, that little green minimal surface, as we say. Okay, and this is the space outside of it. What's downstairs? We're not actually that concerned with that. If we wish, we could take a continuation, and this is a so-called other universe. So if you ignore the second half of this, you recognize this as what? The Schwarzschild wormhole, okay, essentially. All right, and so this surface right here, the brain, I've illustrated that with a kink, and here we have the mirror copy of it all. All right, that's how we would visualize the geometry. These are a few math details. I'm not going to be using these in the future. The surface in question, okay, a coordinate sphere, okay, taken to be very much smaller than that characteristic curvature scale, right, of the bulk. Okay, now we take a trial geometry, a conformally flat metric to describe this situation. Again, this is just spatial geometry. And as I said, there is a well-known way to describe initially static spatial geometry. Okay, and it boils down to this equation here. It's a equation that needs to be solved for that conformal factor. Okay, this is not the warp factor, remember, just a different conformal factor, okay, to describe the geometry. We have two boundary conditions. Okay. This one is well known at the black hole surface or throat, and technically speaking, this picture only holds when the black hole is sufficiently far from the brain, as I'll go into in a few more details in a moment. Okay, now at the brain, the boundary condition turns out to be nonlinear, and this makes it a difficult problem to solve in general. Okay, how can we get away from this nonlinearity? Well, remember that a cosmological constant and brain tension, they're both proportional to inverse powers of little l. When little l is large, that suggests, to a first approximation, this entire term here can be neglected, okay, if the black hole is sufficiently near the brain. Okay, and that, in fact, is what we do first. So there's two approximations, or two methods of attack, I should say. Okay, this first one, we approximate little l as essentially being infinite. It reduces that nonlinear problem to a linear problem. Okay, And it is of the form, in one higher dimension, the same form that Misner dealt with in the 60s by a so-called method of images. And he named it this simply because it has a great similarity to the method of images in electrostatics. Okay, you can build a solution to that field equation up there as in electrostatics by adding sources. Okay, and these dots here represent the couple of image points, image sources that you place down, and it actually turns out to be an infinite sum. Okay, and there's a few more details on the slide I don't really need for our talk here. The main point is the following. Okay, you can analytically understand that green surface, that's the black hole, the so-called throat, as we call it. Okay, you can find that analytically. It is a certain proper distance from the brain, measured as follows. Okay. If you have the black hole this is if the black hole is sufficiently far from the brain, again, still in the vicinity of that brain, and therefore with a curvature length little l, that can be taken to be infinite to a good first approximation. Okay. If that throat is sufficiently near the brain, you must find numerically, okay, there is I refer to the term minimal surface, and you find an outermost minimal surface that is distorted, okay, and actually touches the brain. Okay, so in this case, we're not interested in this green surface. The appropriate area to consider of the black hole. The black hole is in fact distorted and is in fact given by that outermost surface there. Okay, yeah, question, yeah.
It might have been on the previous slide.
Yeah.
So the black hole is found when psi is infinite, or is it?
Not when psi is infinite, no. It's certainly finite on this surface.
So then what is the condition?
The condition is a geometrical condition. It's a so-called minimal surface condition. You're essentially looking for a minimal surface condition. Okay, it's this condition here. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So you solve the second equation and then use the first equation to find the black hole.
Essentially, yeah. Question?
So then does that minimal surface have on the brain interpretation of being the trapped null surface?
Could you repeat the question?
In normal 4-feet general relativity, the black hole horizon is a null surface.
Mm-hmm.
Is the same true?
It's a null surface in space-time.
In 4 or 5?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. The surface we're considering here is, if you like, an intersection of that null surface with a, spatial hypersurface. Okay, and maybe I could back up one slide. I skipped over a small detail. Technically, we're locating what's called an apparent horizon, and that's essentially what you were asking about, the trapped surface. Yeah, we're locating an apparent horizon in the initial data, as we say, or in the spatial hypersurface, in the moment of time. This is the best one can do. Okay, one cannot locate the entire null surface in space-time. One can, however, locate the so-called apparent horizon in the space, in the spatial geometry, and that's what we have to work with. And so that's the appropriate area that we do hold fixed. Okay. And as I said, it's a trial geometry. And we're not worried about the fact that the area we're considering is an apparent horizon. So the apparent horizon, generally speaking, lies inside the true intersection of the event horizon with that spatial surface. It coincides with it when the black hole is in fact static, as opposed to initially static. Okay. So to continue. The mass in question, okay, the goal then is to work out, hold the area fixed, and get an expression for the mass in question, and extremize it, or look for an extremum. Okay, and as I said, this part needs to be done numerically. Okay, and it's not that difficult. I'm not going to describe it in great detail. The setup here in the method of images has a couple of parameters in it. It turns out that you can, you know, say how large in coordinate language your black hole, your throat is, okay? And there's a scale factor, little c. There's a parameter, little mu zero, as it's called, okay, in this notation. And you can vary those two things. Okay, and you can essentially rephrase the constant area condition in terms of a condition in that parameter space. Okay, that's how we actually did it. And the result is the following. So the mass in question, okay, you know, read off in a very simple way from essentially a multipole expansion, okay, which is here. Okay, what's it going to depend on? Well, it's going to depend on this length here, and that's the length to the throat. Be the throat can be sufficiently far from the brain, and it can actually be inside there. The length L serves as a good measure in either case of the distance of this black hole or this distorted black hole. Okay, how far it extends from the brain in that case. And the result that you find is the following. Okay, so each dot here represents an initially static black hole. Okay. And all the points here on the blue curve, okay, those are those black holes that are on the brain. You know, this one more distorted, that one nearly spherical. Okay, and those green points, those represent the completely analytical results. Okay, and it says something quite expected. Okay, at large distance L, okay, the mass in question is well, essentially given by the mass of a black hole as defined by area. This is the usual Schwarzschild relation in one higher dimension, okay, between mass and area. And then there's a Newtonian type interaction term, okay, and it's the interaction between that black hole and its mirror image over there, okay. And okay, are there any static black holes? Each point here is an initially static black hole. There is one static black hole given by the extremum right there. It is, in fact, a local minimum. Okay, and the variational principle says that that will be a static black hole. Okay, now as we said, that static black hole is well known numerically, but it's given a new interpretation here. Okay, by the way, it is stable because it's a local mass minimum, not a local mass maximum. Okay, so we're thinking essentially as if we have a particle with an effective potential. Okay, and moreover, this black hole is not only stable, it's strongly bound. Okay, the binding energy, that's the difference between the energy or the mass far away and the energy on the brain. Okay, now in our paper we worked out a very very general result based on general arguments. You don't need to necessarily have a Z2 symmetry, as I said, so for reflection you could consider a Zn symmetry if you wished. Okay, and this particular number right here, okay, is around 26% of the, this one right here, around 26%, the binding energy is in about 26% when you have 5 space-time dimensions D and a Z2, that is mirror reflection symmetry. So this binding energy, if it's around 26% of the mass value on the brain, that's significant. Relativistically speaking, that's a significant binding energy. Okay. So let's see. In the next slide, I'm just going to take it further and say, you know, we neglected the cosmological constant in all of this. Okay. Or we neglected the, well, yeah, neglected the cosmological constant. In other words, little l was infinite. Okay. If you go further from the brain, you have to realize that you are, in fact, in a curved space. Okay. And the problem then becomes definitely nonlinear. And I'm not going to go through a great number of details here, but we set up a perturbation series, you might call it. Okay. And the conformal factor, if it were just the Randall-Sundrum solution, you'd have a warp factor. That would be your only answer. We can set up a perturbation series that is well posed. The first field here, we call it phi 1. Okay, that carries all the main information. These other fields are simply perturbations. We can examine and confirm that they are indeed well controlled. Okay, so. That was introduced at a later point for possible convenience. Okay. It's not necessary. It's just I'm just matching the form we used in the paper. Yeah. So why these extra factors? There's a certain expression which has a nice sort of divergence form for a possible use in a flux integral or something. Okay, so it amounts to solving for this field phi, and that actually determines the mass. Okay. And you'll notice, in particular, this field is proportional to a 1 over length? Okay, it's not 1 over length squared. Okay. And that's to be expected, okay, based on the reproducing of Newtonian gravity, okay. And in Lisa Rendell's original paper, this was referred to as localized gravity on the brain, and it persists even when you're off the brain. Okay, so I don't want to go through all the details, but what you find is that the mass in question is very similar to what we found before. Okay, the first term here, the so-called rest energy term, is actually now redshifted, okay, by the location of the black hole in the bulk. And the interaction term between the black hole and its mirror image is also modified by that conformal factor. Okay, so that's perhaps also to be expected. Okay, so here's the summary. This is actually a good summary slide of this investigation. Okay, so in this case here, the green curve represents what we found before. Okay, and this red curve represents what we have now. Now I've chosen a certain value of the area in terms of little l for illustration. Okay, and you can see now that we do have a mass extremum, a local maximum, in fact. The red curve is more honest than the green curve. The green curve should not be used at that point. The two curves do match very well in a certain region. Okay, and if you extend even further, what you find here is that the main effect is just that overall warp factor effect. That is the dominant effect. Okay, are there any static black holes? Well, yes, the one we just mentioned. And in fact, it's unstable.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what it does, that black hole, it levitates out in the bulk. Okay, it's at the special position where, right, its attraction to the mirror image is evidently balancing the repulsion from the brain, but if you move it, replace it, and release it at rest, shall we say, just to one side or the other, it either falls toward the brain or it is repelled. Okay. And in addition, you can work out a new binding energy value, and you look at this picture here. Okay. So in other words, that extremum there is a little below the green curve. The mass value is a little below. And that means the binding energy is a little smaller than before. Okay, a little smaller because it's being repelled. It's feeling a repulsive effect, and therefore slightly less strongly bound, you might say. Okay, so that is a summary of the first part of the talk. And the second part is quite short, actually, by comparison. Maybe I should ask if there are any questions. There, yeah?
So this is an unstable solution, so it's going to be driven towards
this,
the brain.
This one,
right.
Yeah.
Towards
yeah.
the brain, away from the brain.
Yeah.
If I have the opposite case, if this picture were inverted, right, I mm-hmm. have a stable case, but would that also not imply that any black hole in the brain would sort of be ejected, because then I have a maximum that it would head up towards the brain, but if it's each more close to the tree, that would be a maximum at that point.
Okay.
So the black hole on the brain would be unstable against translations, and any black hole forming on the brain would be pushed off.
Right, and you're talking about this curve being upside down?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, and we'd have to imagine how or why that would be.
Right, so if we had that, we would see black holes.
Sure, yeah.
So we kind of had to find it.
Yeah, yeah. Question, yeah.
So then again, maybe you're going to talk about this. Mm-hmm. If some process produced black holes, that's out there.
They roll in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Is there any way in which you could use anything to sort of say, you could say what that might look like, but also how, just plug in some numbers out of the hat, how long that would take?
How long that would take?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, that requires dynamics. But.
Sure, exactly. That requires dynamics. And I think, I think you'd have to time evolve the spatial geometry. I think that would be, have to be the way you would do it.
Do people, I mean, you mentioned people solve this geometry numerically. Do they solve the dynamics?
No, not as far as I know. Not as far as I know. No, I believe the static geometry for the black hole in the brain is complicated enough. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so again, this is, you know, the energy interpretation of static black holes. A static black hole extremizes total energy, and it can be stable or unstable. Okay, and in particular, this is the stability of that black hole on the brain is very relevant for LHC experiments, because if we do create a black hole, and let's say, for discussion purposes, it's static when it's created, it will stay on that brain and won't leave, and we can study its evaporation. Okay, much more interesting to study that evaporation than detect missing energy. Okay, so I'm going to go to the next part of the talk, which is similar idea and quite short. And this is work I did with a student. Okay, and by the way, Shaker, my student, he gave a talk on this research, and he actually won a first prize at the California State University annual student research competition this year. All 23 campuses participated, over 200 students participated, and he won one of those first prizes. Okay. It was quite exciting, actually, and when they were, the keynote speaker was talking about inventors. Right, we were all waiting for the prizes, or finding out who won those prizes. And he said, you know, mentioned one of the inventors was Edison, had to do with electricity. And the other inventor or pioneer was Einstein, had to do with gravity. And I turned to him and I said, well, that's 2 out of 3. Your chances look pretty good. You might win something. Who knows? The talk, of course, was written well before. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about charged black holes, okay, and extremum of energy applications. Okay. Now, so there is a well-known geometry, okay, describing a set of as many black holes as you wish that are, in fact, static. Okay. And they're charged. And so the intuition here is that the repulsion and they have like charge, okay, charge of like sign. The intuition here is that the repulsion between the electric charges balances the attraction between the two masses. So each black hole is an individual mass m. There is a total energy to the system for the space. Okay. Now, I'm going to round this up and say for nearly 50 years, this has been the interpretation. And it's not to say there isn't math that goes behind that interpretation. There is. But it would be nice to come at it from an energy perspective. Okay. And the reason I use the word interpretation here is that, mathematically speaking, if these charges and masses do not obey a certain relationship, then the only way to have them be static is to have, mathematically speaking, a strut, or if I was going to give a colloquium, I would say called a curtain rod or something. A mathematical strut, fancier language, conical singularity, that exists in the geometry to keep those two masses apart, for example. Okay, as opposed to falling inwards. Okay, if that's the dominant effect. Okay. And so, you know, that's if there's a very special geometry, however, that requires no such artificial devices where the black holes can just sit there and remain static. Okay. And so I use the word interpretation because there's no strut or anything. The interpretation is it's due to forces. But it would be nice to investigate it and see if we can use the energy extremum approach. Okay. So the relationship, the well-known condition, and this was worked out all the way back almost 1950, and Hartle and Hawking revisited it and, you know, and really confirmed it as a black hole phenomenon in the 70s, early 70s. Okay, and the condition is that these charged black holes are extremal, right? They in fact are known as extremal black holes. They have the maximum possible charge to be a black hole. In other words, in magnitude, each charge equals each mass. Okay, and the purpose of this student project was to rediscover or rederive that condition completely from an energy point of view. Okay, so, and this, as far as I know, this is the first energy interpretation of that condition. I'd like to know if anyone knows of any other work on the subject. I don't think there's any. So what we do is we take a slightly more general geometry, an initially static geometry. So we have charges which could be small or at most the mass. Okay. And that's a well-known geometry. And extremize it and derive that condition. That's what it boils down to. Okay, extremize the energy of that system. So here's the sketch, right, with the black holes as coordinate spheres, and there are some coordinate distances between their centers. Okay, and they all have an individual mass m. And this is an example with three black holes. You can, in principle, write down as many black geometry with as many black holes as you wish. Okay, so I'm going to just review that very quickly, so you see what it looks like. And you want to use that geometry. And it turns out we found it convenient to just calculate each black hole's area. That's geometry, the geometric property. Black holes are, remember, just geometry. That's all they really are. Okay, and we found it even more convenient to consider large separations, or equivalently, small black holes. Okay, small masses compared to those separation distances. And we proceed in powers and work through a few orders in this expansion, and found exactly what we were expecting to find. Okay, and so it just goes like this. Okay, a little bit about the geometry. Okay, it looks like this. If it were flat space, and again, it happens to be a conformally flat situation. Okay, this is what due to Brill and Lindquist. Okay, this solution. And here's the function f. These parameters, alpha and beta, okay, they're related to the physical quantities, the mass of each black hole, the charge of each black hole, the total energy of the system. All right. All right, now I'm not going to be that so much concerned with that distance locating each black hole. More interesting is the difference between such quantities. These are rijs, the interseparation distances. Interestingly, they are coordinate distances, and they're not proper distances. Okay. Okay, so you know it's fairly straightforward if you go back to the original paper of Brill and Lindquist, you know, to extract the mass and charge. Okay, of each black hole. The total energy is a very simple thing, again, read off essentially from a multipole expansion as the sum of those alphas and betas. Okay, now alphas and betas are very convenient, but they're only a means to an end, really. Okay, you can invert those relationships, of course, and get the alphas and betas in terms of the masses and charges, and when you do that, you're expanding in those inverse powers of those separation distances. And again, the energy is still the sum of alpha and beta, okay, for all black holes, all n black holes. Okay, I'll quote the result of plugging those two things there into the energy expression shortly. Okay, so, you know, you go ahead and calculate the area of a black hole. When you're near a black hole, you have to go use some spherical coordinates. There's a certain coordinate radius. I'm going to call that big R. Okay, and so forth. Okay, an undergraduate can do this, has done this. And it's, to some extent, reproducing what Brill and Lindquist did, unless, you want to go to higher order, and that's in progress right now. Okay, I'll indicate that shortly. so that area, if you express it for convenience in terms of those masses and charges, to get a little physics back, you, in fact, find that you get a zero here. As I said, these terms are under consideration, okay, still under consideration. But interestingly, you get a zero here, and it says, you know, the very first approximation would be infinite distance for all the r's. And you could do that calculation. In fact, my student did that first and found, of course, that. And even when you include the first order terms, as you might say, you know, inverse distance terms, you get cancellation. You get a zero. It suggests very strongly that that each black hole doesn't, in some sense, know about the other black holes. It thinks it's isolated all by itself. And that makes a certain amount of sense, I guess. You can solve this for mass easily enough. And in fact, this zero here due to that cancellation, this is in fact the relationship for a single charged black hole between mass, area, and charge. Okay. So, you know, the punchline follows. At this point, it's a good problem for a student because it's essentially a calculus problem. Okay. The energy is the sum of alphas and betas. For physical purposes, it's nice to write the energy in this form. It has the expected Newtonian interaction energy, the Coulomb interaction energy, and then the sum of the rest masses. Again, little c has been set to 1. Okay, and again, these terms are under investigation. But the mass in question is in fact a function of area and charge. So if we wish to write it this way, we can view this energy as a function of several variables, right? Area and charge and those distances, R. Now, how should you extremize this thing? That's a good question. You can appeal to that first law of black holes that I mentioned earlier. Okay, you can appeal for that is very well known for a single black hole, and you can stare at that, and that can guide you. Okay, or you can just mathematically play around with it. I had the student do the latter. And you know, you take one extremum, and you're going to hold these two things. It turns out to reproduce what you want. In other words, from the student's point of view, he's discovering a law of black holes. How does the energy extremize itself to yield that static condition? Okay. Well, it's done holding charges fixed and those distances are fixed. Okay. So we have n partial derivatives to set to zero, and you can write that out and boil it down, and you find exactly the condition we were expecting, given, of course, that the black holes are sufficiently far apart from each other. You have to stare at it and say, oh, that term's not zero, because they're sufficiently far apart. Okay. And it's really just that simple. And okay, so I'm basically ready to conclude, unless you have questions on this. Yeah?
Is it kind of interesting that when you take this extremum, yeah, you end up on kind of the boundary of the allowed region?
Exactly. That's very interesting. Yeah. Exactly. And that might have been expected, right? Extremal.
If you had been just a little bit outside, then there would have been no stable thing, right?
Yeah, in fact.
QI had to be a little bit bigger than MI.
Then you'd have a naked singularity.
Yeah.
That's, right. Yeah, yeah.
So, in terms of thinking this, you say, as an energy interpretation, are there other things like this?
Mm-hmm.
What strikes me about this is that this is essentially VPS bounds based on periods.
Right? Yeah.
One way to think about VPS bounds, even in non-supersymmetric theories, is if you think about embedding them in supersymmetric theories and then pulling back down, where does the VPS bound come from? It comes from the fact that Q squared is equal to the energy plus the central charge, right? And so the central charge is really appearing in the same role as the energy. And then when you saturate that bound, because Q squared is greater than or equal to zero, the energy and the charge wind up equal to each other. And so it strikes me that probably one way to understand what's going on here is as a VPS bound that's descending from this supersymmetric theory, which would, of course, perforce be essentially an energy condition. And the other thing that strikes me as plausible within this context is if I think about this as, take the original Coates quantum model in five dimensions, and we want to extremize the energy in five dimensions. But then think what that would look like down in Minkowski space across S1. We're going to get 4D gravity and an electric charge. But the electric charge really, right, is really a mode of the 5D gravity, including the energy statement.
Right.
So it strikes me as plausible that you could get this result by starting, there's a supersymmetric charge, but also starting with 5D gravity, just doing ordinary, what we already know about black holes in 5D, but then saying, apply that to the state, M4 across S1, and it wouldn't be surprised if this pops out, because the charge then really is just another momentum motor contribution to the energy.
Right, yeah, and in fact, the BPS idea, when we write this up, the BPS idea was definitely on my mind, for consideration, for making contact, definitely. Yeah, thanks for the comment. Yep. Okay. Quick question.
Quick question. It's probably the undergraduate question.
Okay.
Which is it interesting or not that the area doesn't depend on any of the other black holes?
I would say interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, this right here.
Yeah, so
exactly. Exactly. What comes next? I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. We're working on it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is we're very excited to see what happens next.
Okay.
Yeah. Zero or not. And how does it pan out?
I mean, without the terms, you're sort of in the infinite distance. Of course, theory doesn't care about the other.
Yeah.
So it's not, in that sense, it's not interesting.
Right, what's interesting is what happens when they interact.
If the next term, they feel we're independent.
And then you would not get the A, you would get that, you would not get the Q equals M.
I mean, if you believe the EPS kind of thing, those terms might not be there.
Sure.
That would be definitely an A.
Yeah, and. Yeah, and there's another way to address it. I didn't write it down, but. Well, you can work out the interaction energy. And the interaction energy is another way to get your hands on it. It's the difference between the total energy and the sum of those individual masses. And okay, I guess it's not going to be found in a convenient place on these slides. Okay, right here it's just that quantity. And you can see that m equals q sets that to zero. And so what do you think is going to happen over here? Probably zero. Okay, that's another sort of side to that story. Maybe worth investigating. Okay, so in any case, black holes, static black holes extremize their energy. We can prove that as a so-called variational principle. gives you an important result for LHC experiments. We won't lose that black hole if we make it on our brain, if we live on such a brain. And then for the charged black holes, seems to be a new interpretation for something that was long known. Okay, using a force, intuition of forces. And we're going to put it on the archive with some more information. Yeah, okay, thank you.
Schedule with Amy, if you have more questions.
Yeah, any more questions? Yeah, I didn't want to go over time, so.
Can I ask you one question?
Sure, sure.
So I'm intrigued by your relation to the LHC.
Yeah.
So suppose black holes produced in a TEV collision.
Yeah.
And you kind of showed this potential. Will this black hole kind of oscillate back and forth?
That's a good question. It might wobble. It might ring. I'm not sure it's going to leave the, you know, but maybe not oscillating in the sense of leaving the brain and coming back to the brain. It's a good question, though. I don't know, honestly know the answer.
So if it's moving back and forth, would it radiate gravitational
radiation? Oh, sure. Sure.
So do you have any ideas about the scales? So how much energy is it radiating?
No, gravitational waves are not my specialty. So no, offhand. Yeah, I haven't worked it out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.